It is my great pleasure and honor to represent the Board of Trustees of Brigham Young University in conferring an honorary doctoral degree upon General Brent Scowcroft. General Scowcroft, will you please join me here at the podium? In a life to which at this point has been lived across the administration of 12 presidents of the United States, General Brent Scowcroft has been a key and trusted advisor to the last five, and as National Security Advisor to President Bush, is a steady and vital associate in ongoing relationships between the White House and leaders of all other nations across the world. Our honoree today was born in Ogden, of Mormon pioneer heritage. He grew up in a loving home with two older sisters, one of whom is here today, guided and encouraged by devoted and involved parents. From the beginning, it was very apparent that Brent was quick and alert, comprehending material as rapidly as could be placed before him. His friends during those high school years described him as a super student and a very good athlete. He participated on the track team and he played golf. But it was skiing that became his real love, and he comes home regularly to ski the slopes of Alda, Utah. Because of his excellence as a student, it was possible for Brent's parents to consider the very best university education available. His ultimate decision was to forego Harvard, Yale, Cornell for the U.S. Military Academy, where he entered in 1944 and ultimately graduated with the accelerated post-wartime class of 1947. Brent chose the Army Air Corps for his future career and immediately entered pilot instruction. While he was training in a P-51, he barely survived a crash landing in the New Hampshire swamp and spent the next several months in a body cast, recuperating from a broken back. Ironically, the silver lining to that fateful grounding accident turned out to be larger than the cloud. It was to be a major turning point in a career made brilliant not by military air prowess, but by the necessary shift toward the intelligence and administrative branches of the military, where his special skills, incisive mind, diplomatic understanding, and tireless work schedule were to hasten his rapid rise to the highest advisory roles in the White House. During the past three decades, General Scowcroft's influence and responsibilities have steadily broadened. He's moved from the United States Air Force headquarters to the Office of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, to the White House staff, and then to two separate appointments as National Security Advisor, first to President Ford and now to President Bush. On July 3, 1991, General Scowcroft received one of America's most distinguished honors when the Medal of Freedom was presented to him by President Bush at the White House. Two different times, once during the Ford administration and again during the first Reagan administration, it was my privilege to be part of the same executive branch team with Brent Scowcroft. Though my association with him was not as close as I would have liked it to be, it was sufficient to lead me to the conclusion that our honoree today is not only an accomplished and brilliant military strategist, but also a compassionate man who cares very deeply about his fellow human beings. For his lifelong commitment to education, exhibited in his own learning and teaching, for his worthy efforts in the cause of peace through service to his country, for his brilliance as an incisive and accurate analyst and advisor to the most powerful leaders of the world, and for the honorable life he lives, Brigham Young University is pleased to present to Lieutenant General Brent Scowcroft, U.S. Air Force retired, the degree of public service honoris causa.
President Hinckley, President Lee, distinguished guests, fellow graduates, parents, friends, ladies and gentlemen, may I first express my appreciation, deep appreciation, to the Board of Trustees for the great honor that you have bestowed upon me. I'm very humble at both the degree and the very generous remarks that President Lee made. To the graduates, congratulations. You have arrived at one of life's great transitions. Most commencement addresses are filled with advice for coping with this transition successfully. By and large, that advice has not proved to be an indispensable part of the graduate's education, and I don't propose to contribute my bit to that body of literature. You are graduating at a time when the world is going through the same sort of transition that you are in your personal lives. The world is moving from one historical era to another, and you are joining the world, as it were, at a period of dramatic change. Only 4 years ago, when many or most of you began your studies here, the world was a very different place. In historical terms, change has taken place at an astonishing pace. It is this historical transition that I would like to discuss with you this afternoon. You have spent your lives in a world caught in the grip of the Cold War. Indeed, you were born at a particularly difficult period, at a time when this country was enmeshed in the travail of the Vietnam conflict. The Cold War, in all of its manifestations, seemed then to be a permanent, almost all-pervasive fixture of our environment. And suddenly, it has disappeared. Eastern Europe, where the Cold War began, is free. The Berlin Wall is down. Germany is unified. And, most astonishing of all, the Soviet Union, for nearly half a century the bête noire of our existence, is no more. And beyond that, many of the foreign policy issues outside of Europe and the Soviet Union, which have been so preoccupying to the American people, sometimes for decades, have also been or are being resolved. In our own hemisphere, Nicaragua, El Salvador, Panama. In Africa, Angola, Namibia, as well as the encouraging progress in South Africa in the construction of a new political structure. In Asia, the communist aggression, civil war, and bloody deadlock in Afghanistan is drawing to a close. And with Cambodia now under five power and United Nations supervision, the long and bitter conflict in Southeast Asia may finally be drawing to an end. This is a profoundly encouraging picture. It is testimony to decades of American leadership, sacrifice, patience, and determination. We have, with our allies, won the Cold War. As I said at the outset, we stand at the threshold of a new era of history. What kind of an era will it be? History does not reveal its choices, but perhaps never before, at least in this century, has there been a better opportunity for us to shape the world in ways more compatible with U.S. values and principles. But now, at this time of great promise, there are voices telling us, reasonably enough, that we have done enough, that it is time to turn our attention inward to the many domestic problems which confront us, and let others carry the burden of managing the world's problems, at least for a time. These voices point out that there are no overwhelming threats to the free world, and our domestic situation is in dire need of attention. It is an appeal which has come from both the right and the left of our political spectrum. More than that, such behavior would be in the tradition and pattern of U.S. behavior for much of this century. Let me illustrate. In the aftermath of World War I, the world looked similarly benign. No great threats to U.S. security were apparent. In response to that environment, the United States withdrew into isolation, disbanding its military and refusing to join in the League of Nations. The consequence was the nourishing of the seeds of World War II. Along the way, our economic retreat into protectionism in the early 1930s helped to keep the world mired in depression until it was finally ended by the arrival of World War II. Similarly, after World War II, we rushed pell-mell to withdraw our forces from abroad and to dismantle them. This was done so thoroughly, all the while claiming we were only cutting fat, that what was the finest military machine the world had ever seen in 1945, only 5 years later, was very nearly thrown off the Korean Peninsula by the forces of a third-rate dictator. In response to that conflict and to Soviet aggression in Central Europe, we had to rebuild our forces and redeploy them to Europe, all at enormous additional cost. Even in the midst of the Cold War in the 1970s, lulled by the hope of detente and discouraged by the experience of Vietnam, we cut our defense expenditures, thus encouraging the Soviet Union in the notion that the correlation of world forces was changing in its favor. The result in the following decade was a requirement for costly increases in our defense programs in order to disabuse the Soviets of their misconceptions about U.S. strength and resolve. Those increases, incidentally, set the stage for Gorbachev and the dissolution of the Soviet Empire. This is, on the whole, a depressing record. While there is, of course, no reason to believe that history would necessarily repeat itself yet again, there is likewise no holiday from history. Each time we have dismantled our forces and/or turned our backs on involvement in world security, that is, each time we have taken a chance that no threat to U.S. security would emerge, we have been sadly disappointed and forced to re-involve ourselves in haste and at highly and wastefully increased cost. There is another assumption made by the Come Home America advocates which warrants closer examination. Aside from the question of whether there is a specific threat to U.S. security developing, that assumption is that the United States could prosper in a world of turbulence and chaos, or one divided into protectionist economic blocks. As the world's most advanced and powerful nation, with political and economic interactions throughout the world, we are affected daily by decisions and events around the globe on a variety of issues. For the United States, interdependence is not a policy, it is an inescapable fact of our existence. In economic affairs, that interdependence is statistically evident. United States foreign trade, exports and imports, was equivalent to 23% of the U.S. gross domestic product in 1991, as compared to only 9.3% in 1960. 1/3 of our national economic growth between 1965 and 1990 resulted from increased exports. In addition, the strongest sector of our economy during this recent recession has been the export sector. One fact of the modern world seems inescapable. The domestic well-being of the American people cannot be separated from the impact of political and economic developments abroad. What conclusions can we draw from this review? First and foremost, we have most certainly and decisively won the Cold War, but we have not yet secured the peace. Second, we have perhaps an unparalleled opportunity to help to create a new world order, one more conducive to the values Americans have held dear for 200 years. Third, our efforts should be based on the philosophy of the prevention of world crisis, not on the neglect of world developments and military preparedness until an overwhelming threat to U.S. security faces us. A new world order will appear. The issue is not whether there will be a new world order, but whether the nature of that order will be shaped significantly by the productive involvement of the United States. We are striving now to take advantage of the current world situation to shape this new world order and thus finally to secure the peace. The dimensions of our involvement are primarily threefold: political, economic, and security, and suggest what the new world order can and should become. In the political realm, our strategy is to support and encourage the forces of political pluralism. While democracy may not be instantly adaptable to every culture, it, that is democracy, is the best protection we know against the development of aggressive national behavior. We're giving special attention in this regard to the states of Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union. We have planned major political, economic, technical, and sociological programs designed to help convert totalitarian societies mobilized for aggression into societies of political pluralism and market economies dedicated to the welfare of their citizens. Yes, this is a major undertaking. It will require investment and engagement on our part. But whatever we must invest now to see democracy succeed pales in comparison to what we will need to spend if democracy fails and new threats emerge. Winning the Cold War cost us hundreds of billions, indeed trillions of dollars. Surely we can afford several billion dollars to win the peace. We should not repeat the failures of the West in an earlier period to come to the aid of the Kerensky or the Weimar governments struggling for survival. It cannot be said that aid to these governments would have prevented the eventual success of Lenin or of Hitler, but not to have made the effort when the stakes, at least in retrospect, were so enormous was at best short-sighted. Democracy is on the march at present in many regions: Latin America, Africa, Asia. We can take great satisfaction from that. But democracy is a fragile flower. It will not automatically thrive in the harsh soil in many areas where it has now taken root, especially without nourishment and attention from the industrial democracies. Recent coups in Haiti and Peru and the attempted coup in Venezuela remind us how reversible is the advance of democracy. Our efforts in the economic sphere are dedicated to the preservation and the expansion of an open world trading system. Its benefit to the American economy and the world economy are incontrovertible. We are engaged at present in a major undertaking called the Uruguay Round to reduce tariff and other barriers to the expansion of world trade. Narrow interests are a constant threat to these efforts. Failure to conclude the Uruguay Round successfully could unleash forces of protectionism which might be difficult to contain. Negotiations on that issue with the European community have been protracted and difficult, however, and the outcome at this point is unclear. The President has made the opening of foreign markets a major priority of his administration. Besides the Uruguay Round, he has concentrated on Japan and, through the North American Free Trade Agreement negotiations and the Enterprise for the Americas initiative, on this hemisphere. Success in these efforts would mean major increases in jobs and enhanced prosperity for all participants. In the realm of security, it has been noted by many that the United States is now the world's only superpower. One school of thought would have us use this power to keep the peace and bring about the new world order on our own, to be the world's policeman, to provide American solutions to problems everywhere. The United States has neither the inclination nor the ability to be the world's policeman. That suits neither the American temperament nor the current world environment. The current forces of nationalism alone would bar success for any such hegemonical design. But that said, only the United States can mobilize and lead the world community against acts of international aggression and lawlessness, as was clearly demonstrated by the recent conflict in the Gulf. Faced with a clear challenge to the rule of law and decency, a challenge that placed in jeopardy vital U.S. and world interests in a critical region at a critical time, the United States acted. Sometimes we moved alone, sometimes with a few, sometimes with the full United Nations, but always we led to defeat aggression. Time and time again, we employed a pattern of consultation, cooperative decision, and concerted action, with the United States contributing its share of resources and more than its share of direction. In the end, we built a coalition of more than 24 nations who, under the political mandate of the UN Security Council, liberated Kuwait, supported by a broader coalition of dozens more who contributed economically and politically to that victory. This is the kind of leadership role which can be played only by the United States. In sum, a new world order congenial to U.S. interests and values will not emerge by accident, nor will it emerge by itself. It will take constant attention, effort, and indeed some sacrifice. But a policy of prevention, as opposed to the costs of curing a world crisis, costs which we have paid in blood and treasure over and over this century, is sacrifice well made. You, all of you, will be involved in this enterprise, whatever path you choose for your own lives. We're talking about the world you will be inheriting, and in turn, passing to your children. Our decisions over the next few years will set the course. Hopefully, we will, as a country, determine that we do not need yet again a threat directly on our doorstep to remind us that the world is still a dangerous place and requires our constant attention. Winston Churchill, in his monumental history of World War II, subtitled his final volume this way: How the Great Democracies Triumphed, and So Were Able to Resume the Follies Which Had So Nearly Cost Them Their Lives. Let us this time prove Churchill wrong. Thank you for letting me share this great moment with you. Congratulations, good luck, and God bless you.